I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
On this show, we've learned all about distributed peer-to-peer networks like blockchain and holochain from guests like Arthur Brock and Michelle Bowens. There are so many possibilities with technologies like these to revolutionize the management of our data, the sustainability of our supply chains, and the function of our economy. But as with any new technology, we have to be very intentional in its development to make sure that we get the outcomes we want.
In this episode, we are speaking with Sherman Washman-Geer, an expert in blockchain and author of the book Token Economy. Sherman is committed to making these technologies understandable and accessible to non-tech audiences so that users from all backgrounds can participate in shaping our future.
Let's take a listen.
Okay, so my name is Sherman Washman-Geer. I'm the founder of Token Kitchen and the author of Token Economy. I've been working in the blockchain Web3 token field for 5-6 years previously. My first endeavor was in Berlin. I started Blockchain Hub Berlin. The idea back then in 2015 was to make the topic around blockchain accessible to a general audience. So I guess this is also one of the reasons I'm here today. We did a lot of education, working groups, and privately funded research around the topics of blockchain and Web3. I then moved on to Vienna, where I co-founded the Research Institute for Crypto Economics at the Vienna University of Economics, together with a professor there, Alfred Taudis. And for 2 years, I was the director and leading the kind of interdisciplinary research and laying the breeding ground for interdisciplinary research on crypto economics. After finishing the first book, which is publicly available also for free on GitHub in various languages, I'm now preparing my second book, and it will be focused on purpose-driven tokens, tokens that incentivize individual action towards a collective good. And in the second book, I will be really focusing on use cases and deep diving into use cases so we can make this abstract topic of token economy more tangible for the reader. And maybe we can deep dive into a few use cases today.
That would be awesome. And you know, you covered a lot there. The main thing that you covered was the advent of blockchain and the possibilities it has for us in organizing ourselves as a society. And for our listeners, we have done a couple of shows that involve blockchain and the corollary of tokenization of activities. So maybe you could just encapsulate for us what you mean by tokenization or the token economy.
Okay. So blockchain really is only one of many technologies in this next generation internet. I like to refer to it as Web3, which is a term that has been coined out of the Ethereum community mainly. And it describes this next generation internet, the backbone of which are blockchain networks and other Web3 networks. They change the data structures in the backend of the internet. They allow us to collectively manage data instead of privately managing data as we're doing it in the current internet. And the application, kind of the killer application of this new collectively managed internet, is the token. And tokens can represent many things. Very often, like in the beginning of the narrative, they were reduced to cryptocurrencies, things that represent currencies, such as Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was the first kind of blockchain token, blockchain network token. It all started with Bitcoin. But tokens can also represent other types of assets, whether virtual or real, but they can also represent credentials, identity-based information, any type of certificate, access rights, and they can also be used to incentivize action. And so tokens are really, to the Web3, what websites were in to the early generation internet or World Wide Web. And we remember the early 90s, when internet was a thing way before the 90s. But the problem before hypertext and HTML was that you needed to understand kind of minimal programming language to be able to like connect to other computers over the web or over the internet. And what happened in the early 90s was that this hypertext programming language was developed with which you could not only very easily create websites with a few lines of code, but you could also easily navigate the web without just with a click, right? Just and for this is a very normal for us today, but back then it was the revolution. And we called it kind of the information data highway. And this early generation kind of World Wide Web revolutionized information. The Web 2 revolutionized kind of the interactions. It made the front end nicer, more user-friendly, but also more programmable. And it brought us like kind of this platform economy, right? Web 1 was the information economy. It revolutionized information, the creation of websites. But we didn't really know what to do with these websites, right? So if for those who remember the early 90s, and maybe you do, many of the websites would say, hello world, you know, yes. Because people could create a website, but what should I write on it? And the first really important websites were search engines, websites that would help you find other websites, right? So that was the first problem to solve over the internet, how to navigate the sea of information that was kind of growing. And then we had this kind of second generation internet, which wasn't like a technical revolution so much, but it was an evolution because it took us around 10 years to really understand what we could do with websites. And we're at the very, very similar stage now when it comes to tokens. While it has become very easy to create a token with a simple smart contract that is collectively managed by a blockchain network, right? Anyone can create a token contract with a few lines of code. But what do I write into this token contract? What's the purpose of the token? How many tokens do I issue? Do I issue more than one token? What is the function of the token? What's the value of the token? What do I do with this, right? So tokens, as I said, are to the Web3 what websites were to the early internet. And we're at the very early stage at finding out what we can do with these tokens.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Like, I think in the early 90s, who would have thought that everything would come, like your banking account would be managed by an iPhone, right? It's a, and I think we are right at this same moment where like Windows open to the future, and it's some of it we can't really imagine still, right? It's really fascinating. When you talk about the purpose-driven tokens, what is the purpose?
Okay, so I would like to explain purpose-driven tokens with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is quite misunderstood. People often say, ah, there is like cryptocurrencies and then there is blockchain, like it's a different thing. It's not, you know, there is no such thing as Bitcoin. You know, there is the Bitcoin network, which is a blockchain network. It was the first blockchain network, right? And in as such, it was revolutionary and it's inspired so many other people to copy what Bitcoin did, to have a collectively maintained network with the purpose to provide peer-to-peer money without financial intermediaries like banks. And how do you kind of incentivize them to play according to the rules and not to validate wrong transactions? And that's really the revolutionary part of Bitcoin and the blockchain network behind it is this mechanism we call proof of work, which incentivizes the individual with newly created Bitcoin tokens that they can earn when they validate a block of transactions. So while many people say that Bitcoin is backed by nothing, that's not true. Because people are providing network services to collectively maintain a public good. Over the years, we've developed other types of network. For example, Steemit. Steemit is a peer-to-peer decentralized social network, very similar to Facebook or Reddit. But it's not managed by a private company with their servers. It's managed by an underlying peer-to-peer blockchain network where people are incentivized for computing services. And anyone who makes a post on this decentralized application or who likes the post can get rewarded with reputation tokens of the Steemit social media network. So Steemit is also a very good example for a different type of purpose-driven tokens, where the token is designed to incentivize individual social media contribution. Mm-hmm. So if you think of a social media network as a public good, instead of a private corporation like Facebook or Twitter enabling this, you can incentivize collective contributions with network tokens. And this is not fiction. Steam, it has been operational for years now.
I think the really interesting question here is the difference between centralization of a network versus a peer-to-peer network. Where do you see the advantages of peer-to-peer, and where do you see disadvantages of peer-to-peer?
So peer-to-peer, in the context of, collectively maintaining computing networks, the advantage is that if we take the example of Steemit, a social media network that is not managed by privately managed service in the backend, but by a peer-to-peer network, the advantage is that nobody owns your data. Right? But your data is transparent to everyone. Now, this data, based on the level of cryptography that you use, the type of cryptography, can have more privacy by design or less privacy by design. But nobody is the custodian of your data because it's managed peer-to-peer. Right? So this is one of the big advantages that if we get it right, and whether we get it right is a question of privacy by design, is a question of how we apply cryptographic means, but the question of privacy is a different one. If we don't get it right, it can become a super transparent control machine, right? So the advantage of these blockchain-led peer-to-peer networks is that nobody owns our data anymore. And the problems that we have around Cambridge Analytica scandal, they won't be any, it's not one private company that can use our data, but kind of we can use our own data. So we have a completely different system architecture. But since this is not a tech session, nor and we don't have enough time, we can't go into the details, but transparency and kind of over what happens to my data is one of the big advantages of these peer-to-peer networks on a private level. On a collective level, there are many interesting use cases around, for example, supply chain transparency. You know, where do our products come from? The provenance of goods and services, of energy, et cetera. So many of the projects we're currently working on is about how we can use Web3 networks for completely new types of data management, where the mango farmer in a certain country remain the owners of the mangoes until the mangoes reach final destination. And if we manage all the data around what happens along the supply chain by Web3 networks, there is full transparency of what happened along, you know, the supply chain, how often did it change hands, and there is more transparency at the end. The mango farmer can make more money, there are less intermediaries, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are many on a collective level, but we have full transparency issues. And on a private level, we have issues of more control over what happens with our data. I guess that's the biggest two advantages of Web3 networks, if we get it right, right? Mm-hmm. But there is this huge trade-off between privacy and transparency. And this is something we have to look at on a case-by-case basis, right? There is no one-size-fits-all solution.
Yeah, it depends on the context you're saying. For example, if you're talking about mangoes, not so much privacy, but if you're talking about personal bank accounts or whatever, it maybe need more.
Exactly. So how we design kind of privacy into these kind of use cases, tokenized use cases along Web3 networks, this is a complex kind of techno legal, ethical question that we have to resolve on a use case basis. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember, you know, around 2000 when Facebook, maybe this is not, I mean, maybe I'm off limits here, but when Facebook came up and everyone was like, yeah, you know, no problem, let's just give the data. And Facebook, I think, had really great potential to really become like a great social media platform helping the world. Not so sure about this now anymore. This is my private personal opinion, you know, and it's become very clear what is the purpose of these machines, yeah, which basically have been growing into how can they generate profit and sucking in the data of people. And so it's basically the kind of the ghost we wanted, we called them, and now we can't get rid of this anymore. Do you think the Web3 is kind of overriding this kind of attitude also of us giving everything away? And have we realized, is there a consciousness? What has happened? And what is the future of all of this? How do you see it?
Is your question whether we can resolve all these problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of hope, and then somehow this has gone too far. And for me, it's been very clear, you know, it's been...
Well, it's the hope. Yeah, but hope needs to be based on knowledge, right? So the hope in the early internet was valid, but if you don't know how the internet works, and most people don't know how data management and the internet work, you know,
right.
A lot of people were warning that like it's going to be lead eventually to centralization because of how the data structures are managed, and it's going to lead to kind of privatization of data, etc.
Right.
So while most people were maybe surprised when Cambridge Analytica happened, like I was like, okay, what's the surprise? You know, it's like we've known this for years. So the Web3 is not a magical technology as the Web1 and the Web2 were not. You know, you have to understand, and this is one of the reasons I wrote my book. And if you would like to understand what the potentials and the pitfalls of this new technology are, you have to, or this new internet is, and this new internet, while it's a technological revolution, or it enables a socioeconomic revolution. And in order to understand that, you have to read it up, you know, read up on it and understand the use cases and understand what Bitcoin really is, because it's more than just a cryptocurrency. You know, it's a purpose-driven token that enables, you know, the public maintenance of a public good. And there are many pitfalls, there are many dangers of this new internet. We can get it completely wrong. We can create a freaky control machine if we get it wrong. You know, just as you would use a knife to usually cook, but you can also kill someone with it, right? That's the same with any type of technology. So no, it's not a magic wand. And no, we won't have magic solutions to our problems. But if we apply this new technology in the right context, we can resolve many of the current issues we have, but we will be creating new issues, and we have to be very careful about these new issues. Yeah. And privacy by design would be one of the things to mind. So your question before was really on spot. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the nature of human being, right? To create solutions that actually produce more problems, and then we create solutions and produce more problems. That's kind of evolution.
Yes, but the innovation cycle is one thing. With every innovation, you solve certain problems, but you bring new problems. That's one thing. But the much more problematic field is that most people don't only use the new solutions. They don't understand the new solutions. Yeah. So we have this knowledge gap. And we really need to... and this is why I'm like frantically writing my books, right, and publishing online and putting it under a Creative Commons license. I want as many people as possible to read this, because we're at the very pivotal stage in time where we can co-create a new type of socioeconomic, you know, a new reality, not mm-hmm. only based on blockchain and Web3, also with many other things happening, many other innovation. But in order to be able to co-create this new reality, I need to understand the potential of this new Web3.
Given that most people won't, you know, we know that most people won't have kind of intimate knowledge of the technology.
You don't need intimate knowledge for most people, but you need enough people. Like in the movers and shakers of society, and throughout, and you need to reach the people outside the tech scene, right? One of the biggest challenges that I'm seeing is that people from the social sciences seem certain generation, the younger generation is different, but like until like my generation or a bit younger, people typically from the social sciences are very anti-technology. Mm-hmm. And you can't be anti-technology. If you're anti-technology, you can't, you know, understand what the potential and the pitfalls of this new technological tool. So unless we have sociologists and political scientists, and we need them in designing this new crypto economic systems, we need an interdisciplinary approach, which is also one of the reasons why I'm writing this book. So we don't need 100% of the population understanding this, but we need a critical mass of movers and shakers from various disciplines who understand what's coming up and who will help us co-create this into in a meaningful way. The future will be decentralized and autonomous organizations that are steered over the internet, and the governance rules of these societies, new internet-based societies, they are kind of baked into the protocol that is tied to the token creation rule. Yeah, but so this is kind of a computational constitution of these kind of distributed internet tribes who all have a different purpose. And this computational constitution cannot stand alone, right? You can create a constitution and have it automatically enforced by computers, but you need to be able to adapt this constitution, this computational constitution over time to the needs of the people who are using this network, and when situations change or circumstances change, you want to be able to adapt it. So this computational constitution has to be enhanced by the human feedback loop, where we co-create, where we create new kind of rules for these computational constitutions. And this is one of the probably biggest pitfalls of many early creators of these blockchain networks. They thought that by once creating the computational constitution for the Bitcoin network, that's done, and it will always stay the same. It's like, oh, we wrote the Bible 2,000 years ago, we don't have to reinterpret it, right? But unfortunately, as circumstances change, even in the Bitcoin network, the Bitcoin network has to adapt to these new circumstances. So governance, general governance questions are, and how we want to have agile governance is not a it's not a technological question. It's a human question.
Yes.
It's a political question. It's an ethical question. And it's a question also because they're economic social networks. It's also a question of who has power in the network. So the question of power structures is very relevant. You know, unfortunately, in many blockchain networks and other applications such as Steemit was super, super well adopted across the internet, but it had over 1 million users in 2016 and 2017. Many people, even I know, were posting on Steemit and making money with Steemit tokens, paying partially their rent. But what happened was that the token design of this reputation token was flawed in a way that those who were early in the game, you could have more reputation with money. You could buy reputation with money, which led to extreme power inequalities in the network, which led to the fact that late adopters had no incentive to come into the network and contribute with content, right? Yeah. So how you design your economic, socioeconomic system is not only an ethical question, but also a question of, yes, power structures, not only whether they're ethical, but whether they make sense and they're sustainable enough so this economy will prevail over a longer period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of this baked-in bias that happens with designers, right? I mean, there's this case at MIT where they looked at artificial intelligence, facial recognition designed by white men, and the technology was unable to come even close to the accuracy for people of color or for women. And so this idea of being very careful with the protocols and making sure that you have full representation and flexibility, super important, you know, otherwise we just carry on our biases in the technology itself, you know?
And it's even worse in the Web3. Thank you for this very, very good example, right? Because the kind of the algorithmic bias that AI showed us, you know, so having the bias of, yeah, not recognizing Black people, et cetera. This can be relatively easily changed once you figured this out. But until then, I mean, very often you would have like these AI protocol bias would lead to a false conviction rates of maybe Black Americans, et cetera, right? Until you figure it out. But once you figure it out, you can account for it. The problem with blockchain networks is worse than in the Web3, which is why it's so much more important to understand how it works. Because once you have your economic incentives baked into an automated protocol that is not led by a centralized institution, where you need a democratic system to change the rules, you have much more system inertia than you would have in a code that Facebook developed. While democracy is a good thing in blockchain networks, it also makes decision-making slow and sometimes impossible. So if you have a bias in your protocol, it will take so much more time to get it out of your system. And sometimes it's impossible because you might have stakeholder groups who will be disadvantaged by changing the kind of economic protocol because they would lose the money if you would change the rules, right? So it's completely new dynamics because we're moving from centrally from private companies to kind of collective digital collectives. That's the paradigm shift. While it has a potential for more inclusion, it also brings the pitfall of democratic systems being slower. And that can be a good thing in evolution, but it can be a bad thing once you have a system flaw in your system, which is why I'm advocating for not just like this mentality that the Silicon Valley developed, this quick and dirty implement and pivot later mentality, is not a mentality that we can be applying in the Web3. Because once you deploy it, it's really hard to move away from the system. Initial system conditions count a lot in the Web3, even more than in the Web2.
I remember I'm a systems engineer, and in the 80s, late 80s, yes, we had this raging debate between rapid prototyping and, yes, good system design based on very hard-fought requirements development and involving all the stakeholders. And the rapid prototyping method won in the 90s. That was the technique that won. And I see now that we're coming back to more kind of meticulous requirements development, speaking to more and more people, you know, and including more stakeholders, different disciplines on certain systems. And I think that's probably a very good thing in this Web3. Yeah.
So, and that's one requirement, what you just said, including more perspectives, testing assumptions, etc. And part of testing assumptions, and I'm very happy to work also together with Block Science. They developed a Python-based kind of economic simulation tool where you can simulate your economic system. It's a dynamic mathematical model where you can kind of simulate your assumptions of your token economy in a system before you really deploy it. And you can then tweak the metrics before you deploy it. Very much like, you know, what you do also in architecture. You don't just build a bridge or a house, you would simulate it, right? And we need that also for resilient economic systems. So if you're interested in that, maybe you want to research what Block Science does, and their work around CatCat is an open source tool. And I think will be tools like CatCat will be pivotal to allowing us to create more sustainable economies in this Web3. Yeah.
Maybe there was one thing I wanted to ask you for a question. Maybe we haven't asked you, or something you would like to as an end thing. I think you actually already gave it to us just in the last couple of minutes.
Well, I actually have what you talked about, use cases, you know, use scenarios, and we've discussed too. We've discussed the blockchain, the Bitcoin case, and we also have discussed kind of supply chain tracing development. Can you offer more socially kind of, when you talked about the commons in the beginning of the conversation, a use case that involves, for example, environmental sustainability or, you know, the care of our earth?
I think the social media collectively maintained social media network is a good use case also, right? But when it comes to sustainability, there are actually many use cases. So you can build a lot of use cases around proof of CO2 emission reduction. And in my book, I've mentioned a few. In my next book, I will mention even more in detail. We, for example, with the city of Vienna, back in the day where I was still working there, we helped the city of Vienna conceptualize a prototype for Vienna Token that was based on sustainable mobility behavior. So they built an app, or they partnered with an app provider that was specialized in tracking kind of your mobility behavior, and it was tweaked to the necessities of the city of Vienna. And if you could prove that you took the bike or you public transport instead of taking a car, there is public data on how much CO2 emission you save by alternative mobility behavior. And if you per 20 kilograms of CO2 emission reduction proved, you would collect a Vienna token, and you could collect maximum 5 Vienna tokens that you can then could then in an app store, in their app store, exchange for cultural activities that partner institutions in the city of Vienna would provide. So you could get a ticket to a museum or a concert or meet the artist. And these were voluntary partners, right? So they weren't forced by the city of Vienna to be part of the system. And this is a very low-key yet impactful use case where you say, like, we as a society have decided that CO2 emission reduction is a public goal, right? And we can find incentive mechanisms. We need to test whether they really make sense, whether they really change behavior. And so we had studies, we're studying, and these are this is an ongoing research and development, whether it actually changes mobility behavior and whether the incentives are incentive enough to change mobility behavior. But very often, just by visualizing the amount of CO2 emission reduction saved, just through the act of gamifying it, it doesn't even have to be 100% accurate. You can track that someone changed their mobility behavior, you can measure it, and you can incentivize it. And that would be one use case, but we have other use cases, and I invite you to read up on it, and we can have a whole section or on this, the elephant use case, proof of biodiversity maintenance could be another token. And there is this interesting use case around the elephants in the Congo Basin, but that's quite a complex and we're over time. So I feel that either you should invite me another time, or in the case of the elephants, I would highly recommend you to maybe next time invite Walid from Rebalance Earth to talk about his one specific use case. Well, I think you'd enjoy that very much.
So what I really appreciated in our conversation, Howard, Sherman points out the importance of Bitcoin. And a lot of people, when you start talking about Bitcoin, it's I think we only see one side of Bitcoin at the moment, or in the mainstream media. I mean, mainstream media, first of all, has discovered Bitcoin, that something like that exists. And then hence the term crypto got into mainstream media, and it is frankly mainly today about speculation. And I think what Sherman points out is this: the invention of Bitcoin is much more worth than just a speculation. The real invention of Bitcoin is this peer-to-peer transferring of data in a secure way, and basically cutting out the middleman. And that is a truly new invention and truly huge step for humanity if we use it in the right way. And I think this comes then exactly to the topic: how do we use this technology in future, and what does ethics and the moral kind of play into this? Yeah, I think that that is kind of leading to what you want to point out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super important to distinguish the invention of Bitcoin, and she's so good at saying that it's a purpose-driven network, right? And that it manages a common asset. And we can do that in so many different contexts, whether it's verifying a supply chain or, you know, she gave these use cases of, you know, kind of the social network and all of these ways in which we can actually control our own data and we can control the sources of where things are coming. And that will really transform our economic system in so many ways. But then there's the big million-dollar question, which is, can we maintain an ethical standard of those technologies such that the kind of errors of humanity are not, you know, kind of baked into the design of those tokens? And, you know, whether it's a token for verifying the, you know, where your beef in the on your dinner plate comes from, or whether it's a token to educate your children, it still has biases that could really turn it the wrong way, right? Yeah. If it's not well designed. And I think she, you know, the idea of inclusion we talk about so much as an ideal, but in this case, it's super important. You have to include many disciplines, many perspectives in the design process of these technologies. And I think our purpose is to make sure that people know that that's important and that those technologies require that level of understanding.
Yeah, it's like, I think for us, I mean, it's very clear that in a couple of minutes, we cannot cover the topic of blockchain or cryptocurrencies, and we can just knock on the door and
open
the door, and there will be a lot of discussion rooms.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, that's the point.
Hours of discussion. Yeah. And I think these discussions are actually necessary to develop a level of thinking which is required to design the future system of the economy, or future systems, plural. It's not just the economy.
Right. It's voting systems, contracts.
Yeah, it goes throughout our society. And how do we, and then also how to agree on something. Super interesting question. Has our democracy worked or not? We're going to have another episode on that as well. But anyways, this is just knocking on doors, trying to open minds, and exploration.
Yeah, I mean, take something that's going to be part of your future and try to understand at least enough to know that we all need to participate.
Right. And let's not just, you know, Bitcoin is Bitcoin, and it has, there are two sides of it, that's for sure. Let's not just see one side.
Bravo.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.